morning, good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 1 minute before 10 o'clock. We've got Between the Covers coming your way in 1 hour at 11 this morning. Today, welcoming local author Ellen Urbani on the launch of her debut novel, Landfall, published by Portland-based national publisher Forest Avenue Press. And at 11:30, Words and Pictures welcomes celebrated cartoonist and author David Chelsea to preview his new webcomic, Are You Being Watched? A modern take on the Faustian legend set in the era of reality television. But first, we've got Air Cascadia is off today. We have an hour-long edition of Flashpoints, today featuring an update on the situation in Syria, among other topics. And that is coming up next on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present The Yes Men Are Revolting as part of the KBOO at the Clinton monthly film series. The Yes Men Are Revolting is a documentary directed by Andy Bickelbaum and Mike Bonanno, which follows the comedy troupe The Yes Men as they stage phony press releases and events to bring attention to environmental dangers and corporate greed. Again, that's The Yes Men Are Revolting, Thursday, August 13th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The revolution will not be brought to you by the shape of a war theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia.
Today on Flashpoints, we begin with our on-the-ground correspondent in Syria, Ala Ibrahim, with an update about the situation there, including news of a 48-hour ceasefire in three towns and new allegations of the use of napalm by the Syrian military. We then follow that up with an analysis by Ali Al-Ahmed of the Institute of Gulf Affairs about the role of Saudi Arabia and Syria in the region. We continue our coverage of the recent spill of toxic waste into the Animas River by the Environmental Protection Agency. Finally, we have two reports filed by senior producer Miguel Gavila Molina, the first about returning ethnic studies to Arizona classrooms, followed by an interview with Richard Montoya of Culture Clash about his new performance piece, Nogales. I'm Kevin Pina, filling in for Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints, your daily investigative news magazine. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we're going to go straight to Syria right after we take a listen first to the Flashpoints headlines with Harry Krinsky.
In breaking news, a warehouse in the northern Chinese city of Tianjin exploded, killing at least 13 and injuring over 260 more. The cause of the explosion is still unclear. Elsewhere, journalists Wesley Lowry and Ryan Riley were charged Monday with crimes they allegedly committed while doing their job and reporting on the unrest following the Ferguson riots. The two could face up to a year in prison for trespassing and interfering with a police officer. In Syria, Iran and Turkey secretly negotiated a two-day ceasefire in three Syrian villages. Finally, after much debate, the Greek parliament finally decided to accept the new bailout agreement. The agreement is projected to bring a tough few years for the Greek economy, though it is the hope that it will eventually lead to prosperity. This has been Harry Krinsky with Flashpoints Headlines. Now back to you, Kevin.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We now turn our attention back to Syria, and we go to our special correspondent, Ala Ibrahim, who is on the ground in Damascus. Ala, welcome back to Flashpoints. So, Ala, first of all, I want you to comment on what's the word there on the ground. We hear that there are negotiations happening directly between Russia and the so-called Syrian rebels. Has there been any response from Damascus about this so far?
No, there hasn't been a response, but there has been a breakthrough today in a regionally brokered ceasefire between Turkey and Iran and Syria. The new ceasefire that should last for the next 48 hours should allow rebels to a certain number of rebels to leave the city of Zabadani. The city of Zabadani is a rebel stronghold west of the Syrian capital, Damascus, that has been under a relentless attack by the Syrian army and the Lebanese Hezbollah for the past two or three weeks. And in exchange for the exit of these hundreds of rebel fighters. The large-scale rebel attack on the towns of Fua and Kisleya in northern Syria, the large-scale attack would stop. The two towns are home to a predominantly Shiite community of over 40,000 persons. And if rebels gain control of these towns, we are speaking about the possibility of having one of the largest massacres in the Syrian war, because the rebels, as we all know, are radical Islamists, and they consider Shiites to be infidels and they should be killed. And so if they took control of Fua and Kafraya towns, we are looking at one of the worst cases of mass killings in the Syrian war.
And that's a voice of Alaa Ibrahim coming to us from Damascus, Syria. I know that you are traveling in a car right now. I imagine you're heading somewhere near where the action is, so bear with us, listeners, when we hear that noise in the background. That's because Alaa is actually traveling inside of Syria right now. So what I'm also wondering, is there new charges today by the so-called Syrian rebels against the Syrian army, claiming that they're actually using napalm in the field? What do you know about that?
Well, today we had other developments, two other major developments. The first is that there has been a mortar and rocket attack by the rebels on the Syrian capital, Damascus. The attacks are still ongoing until now, and they have killed around 14 civilians and wounded 70 others. And later on, the Syrian army retaliated by bombarding one of the rebel strongholds in the city of Duma, north of Damascus, killing more than 30, according to opposition sources.
What about the accusations of the Syrian army using napalm?
Well, napalm is not a weapon that the Syrian army is very likely to use for logistic reasons. First of all, napalm is known to be a Western or an American-made napalm is a Western or an American-made weapon, and it's not used by the Syrian army on a large scale. Up till now, there has been no evidence of use of napalm by the Syrian army. The Syrian army uses a variety of weapons. Not all of these weapons are sometimes proportionate to the attacks launched by the rebels, but in the general context, I haven't seen or heard any evidence that would substantiate the claims that napalm has been used by the Syrian army.
So, according to you, there is no evidence that you have seen on the ground that would substantiate the use of napalm by the Syrian army. The other question I'm wondering is, what are the prospects now of the peace process moving forward, and does that necessarily mean that Bashar al-Assad will have to leave power?
Well, the Syrian government remains steady in its position that the fate of the Syrian president should be decided by the Syrian people. The Syrian government held elections in June 2014, and Assad won in these elections.
We've lost contact completely with him. We will try to get back to him on our next program. In the meantime, just to recap, he has confirmed that there has now been a 12-hour ceasefire that's been in effect for 12 hours thus far, which is expected to last a total of 48 hours in three towns in Syria, that there have been breakthroughs in the talks between Iran and the United States and Russia and the Syrian rebels. It's not clear exactly what role the U.S. is playing, although we do know that they have played a role in backing and arming the so-called rebels inside of Syria that are opposing the regime of Bashar al-Assad. Our special correspondent, Alaa Ibrahim, also said that based upon his experience on the ground and what he has seen, there is no evidence to show that the Syrian military has used napalm. He said again that that is a Western weapon, that napalm is a chemical weapon that is largely used or comes from the United States and Western powers, and that the regime of Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian military don't have access to that. And we're going to, again, try to get back to him in the next couple of days so that we can continue this conversation. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, we're going to continue our coverage of Syria for another perspective on the diplomacy revving up throughout the Gulf with a reported 48-hour ceasefire there. We focus on how talks with Russia are affecting governments known to be backing the Syrian rebels, specifically the Saudis. These talks may represent an important development in the longstanding proxy war between Syrian rebels and the pro-government Syrian forces. They may also mark a change in the unconditional support the Saudis have thus given rebel factions in the Syrian conflict. We're now joined by Ali Ahmed, the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. Welcome to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, sir.
Thank you very much.
So what's your perspective here? We know that there have been talks between Russia and the Saudis directly. Is this marking a change in the role of the Saudi government in the region and in Syria specifically?
I think they are trying to take a different approach. I don't think it is very much different in terms of a larger policy of removing the Assad regime. I think they believe that there is an opportunity to use diplomacy to reduce their spending and their investment in order to topple his regime and change it. I think they believe that there is an opportunity to do this politically, to lessen their investment, and to have a say in the outcome of any post-Assad arrangement. And they believe that the Russians are going to be a partner in this process.
Well, could it also be that it's a partial recognition that their policy has failed, that in fact the forces that they have supported on the ground have been anything but moderate, but in fact have in many cases been just as vicious as the so-called jihadists of ISIS?
I think they always have known that the people they supported, you know, that they supported the extremists of the extreme, and those they supported have been very clearly their policies and the outlook that they have exercised in the past 4 years were very clear. I don't think the Saudis have a problem with that per se, but they do have a problem with the fact how is this affecting them in terms of their standing in the West. If you recall what Joe Biden said late last year about Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries supporting terrorist organizations in Syria, they cannot continue to support these organizations, which the United States and the Western governments and other world powers consider to be terrorists, and they are terrorist organizations like ISIS and Nusra and others, without really having to deal with the consequences of that in terms of the international their standing internationally. So I think they are trying to basically close that door for now and come out with some result. The Saudis and the Gulfies did not support the democratic activists in Syria. They supported only the Salafi, Wahhabi, Al-Qaeda types, and that's their support was restricted to these people. So I think they are worried about that continued support because right now everybody realized it was never the private funders. It was really government agencies who have been supporting these groups all along.
And that's the voice of our guest, Ali Ahmed. He's the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. We're talking about recent moves, a ceasefire that appears to be in effect in Syria. It's been in effect for 12 hours now. It's supposed to last a total of 48 hours. There are also now negotiations directly between the Saudis and the Russian government and the Iranian government, we understand. Now, the Qatar government has also been involved in this in terms of funding so-called rebels on the ground in Syria. And we just recently spoke with our special correspondent from Damascus earlier today, and he basically presented a situation where there really are no moderate rebels who have arms on the ground in Syria, that in fact most of them always seem to, because it's based on an ideology that's religious rather than a secular ideology which is based on democracy, that in fact most of them cannot be called democratic, and that the only seemingly democratic forces are the ones who may be involved in opposition talks, which are at the diplomatic level. How do you see that?
Well, again, you know, we have never seen the Saudis and the Gulf countries support any secular, moderate, progressive forces, even moderate Islamists. The Qataris, the Kuwaitis, and the Saudi government are all, rely on the most extreme version of Islam currently in the world, and they have their support and their policies to support such ideological movement has caused the rise of the terror organizations in the Middle East and across the world. So if really the leading terrorist groups, all their funding, ideology, and political support really goes back to the Gulf countries, mostly Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Kuwait. So you are... it's delusional to think that they are going to support progressive, you know, some kind of a democratic party or a secular party. And they realize that now this could hurt them. And that's why I think they are trying to basically be ahead of the curve and support some kind of a settlement that they will end up being winners. Because this situation cannot really continue, especially with Iraq making some progress. I wouldn't say a lot of progress vis-a-vis the Islamic State, and maybe the United States post the Iran deal is going to take a different policy on Syria, and also its relationship with Iran is becoming increasingly improved. So that really puts those people who support terrorism, the states who support terrorism in the region, at a very peculiar situation.
Now, when you say that their supporting of violent jihadist groups in the region have backfired or boomeranged on them, you're talking about that, you know, recently there have been 91 people who were killed in suicide bomb attacks inside of Saudi Arabia by both Al-Qaeda terrorists and terrorists linked to ISIS. Is that what you're referring to?
No, I don't think that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, you know, in fact, these attacks in Saudi Arabia end up, at the end of the day, so helping the Saudi government because it keeps people from speaking out for reforms and gives the Saudis the image of being a victim of terrorism. But what I'm talking about is increasingly the U.S. government and Western government, who have since September 11 been repeating this narrative that the Saudi government really is a victim here. They are trying their best, but they are unable to control this terrorist inflow. You know, you can see the money, the ideology, the manpower that has come from Saudi Arabia, for example. It has been, we're talking about maybe 10,000 Saudis who have since after the attacks of September 11 have been involved in terrorist organizations and attacks in different countries, in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon,